in the hallway outside the door to the detective bureau. Now this is a surprise. Shouldn't you be in Beverly Hills today meeting with your agents at CAA? I'm working a triple homicide. Yeah, I know. I saw the press conference. It was the first night in weeks there wasn't anything on the news about the indictment of those deputies at the Men's Central Jail. Eve ignored the dig and pressed on. As much as she disliked and disrespected this man, she needed his help. I think the dead guy you found in the truck on Thursday may be connected to our case. How? I don't know yet. Nob smirked, crossed his arms under his chest, and leaned his shoulder against the wall. You know what I think. You're feeding me a line of bullshit. You're eager for another murder to solve, to capitalize on your moment in the spotlight, and this corpse happens to be handy. So you haven't closed it yet? He straightened up, taking a more defensive posture. Don't sound so hopeful. You aren't getting the case. You'll have to wait for a body to drop in your jurisdiction. She resisted the urge to remind him that he was being very protective of a case that he'd pushed into her jurisdiction just a few days ago, but she didn't think that would be a persuasive argument, so she took a different approach. The morning after three people were murdered and dismembered with a knife, your victim was found with his throat slit in a truck parked 100 yards from where our killer lives. I think that's a mighty big coincidence, don't you? Eve said. Nob pursed his lips, considering the implications. I don't want your case, Frank. I just need to know what you've got. What's the harm in telling me? We both want the same thing here, to catch whoever killed him. Nob sighed in resignation and gestured for her to follow him into the detective bureau. The cubicles were large, each with plexiglass dividers on two sides that created a more open feel around sleek, curved desks with flat-screen monitors and stylish, ergonomic desk chairs. He sat down at his cubicle, wheeled over a chair for her, and she sat down. The victim's name is Roger Karpis, Nob said. He works at Malibu Creek State Park. She was familiar with Malibu Creek State Park. It was 8,000 acres of peaks, canyons, rolling hills, and meadows south of Mulholland Highway and west of Las Virgenes. It was originally owned by 20th Century Fox, which used it as various locations for hundreds of movies and television shows. The studio donated the property in the mid-70s to the state, which opened it to the public as a park, but there were film crews in there shooting on almost a daily basis. Some deputies, like Garvey, made extra cash off hours working as set security. The Paramount Ranch bordered the northwest end of the park and also doubled as a shooting location and state recreation area. Karpis was a forest ranger? Eve asked. More like a night watchman. The park is popular with campers and film crews. His job was to make sure nobody burns the place down or vandalizes any movie sets during the night. Nob clicked a few keys and brought up on his screen some gruesome pictures of the victim and his gaping neck wound. We quickly ruled out suicide. Somebody in the passenger seat pulled Roger's head back and slit his throat, practically to the spine. We're thinking it was a hitchhiker, maybe a prostitute. I've never heard of hookers hanging out on Mulholland. That's not how it's done in upscale neighborhoods. They use apps or social media to book anonymous sex, Nob said. We know from Roger's friends and family that he was dealing with a sex addiction problem. Getting blowjobs and handjobs in parking lots was one of his favorite pastimes. Was his wallet or phone taken? Nob shook his head. We're thinking the killer must have been spooked by someone or something. We don't have much to go on. Can you show me the interior of the truck? Eve asked. Nob scrolled through pictures of the bloody cab and the large knife on the passenger seat. She tapped the screen. Has the knife been confirmed as the murder weapon? Yes, it has. It was nice of the killer to leave it behind. We're thinking that maybe it belonged to Roger and he had it in the truck, maybe under the passenger seat or something, and the killer grabbed it as a weapon of opportunity, Nob said. It's a SOG jungle primitive knife, a popular choice among ISIS members for beheading captives. Did you get any prints from it? Nope, he said. I'd like that knife sent to our crime scene unit for analysis, she said. The knife wouldn't have to go far, perhaps just across the room. The LAPD and LASD shared crime lab facilities within the California Forensic Institute on the campus of California State University in Monterey Bay. You think you're gonna find the DNA of your three victims in the hilt of the knife? Nob asked. Yes, she did. And DNA from Donna Stokes, too. I think it's worth checking, Eve said. If I'm right, you can say the LAPD provided the key clue that closed a triple murder that baffled the sheriff's department. Eve was still missing key evidence, but she now believed that the realtor showed up at Tanya's house on Wednesday morning and walked in on a nightmare. Coyle killed Stokes and used her car to dispose of the bodies. That was why his car was clean. Nob regarded her with an appraising gaze. You weren't baffled. You knew what you were going to find before you walked in here. All I did was confirm it and give you a few more facts. That's true, she said. But that spin won't help you much, will it? We're going to look good at your expense. I don't care. The sheriff might, he said. All that matters to me is what's good for the case, she said. Besides, now you'll owe me two favors. How do you figure two? She gave him a stern look. Have you forgotten how we met? I'll have the knife sent over to your CSU, he said. Can you email me the photos you showed me of Roger and the knife? Sure, he said. I'll do it now. Eve thanked him and hurried out of the station as fast as she could without actually running, because with each passing second, the realization of what really happened on that bloody, horrible Wednesday in Topanga was coming to her in revelations that felt like body blows. So much of what they thought they knew about what happened in Tanya's house was wrong. The moment Eve stepped outside, she looked to the south. The smoke from the Topanga fire loomed over the Santa Monica Mountains like huge, vicious storm clouds, seething with thunderous fury. It terrified her. She took out her phone, Googled the Wikipedia listing for the original Planet of the Apes movie, and scrolled through the post to the section labeled Production Information. One line jumped out at her. Most of the scenes of the Ape Village, interiors and exteriors, were filmed on the Fox Ranch in Malibu Creek State Park, northwest of Los Angeles. It was the same park where Roger worked. That was the key piece that she'd been missing. Now she knew how the ranger's truck ended up at the corner of Mulholland and Mulholland, and why Coyle had killed him. But it was everything else that was becoming clear to her now, all of the wrong assumptions that she'd made that was threatening to cripple her with panic and fear. How could I have been so blind and stupid? Eve called Duncan and cut him off before he could finish saying hello. I need to see you, the captain, and the sheriff immediately. It's an emergency. If either of them argue with you, tell them their careers will be ruined, and more people will die if they don't get their asses to the station right now. What have you found? Duncan asked. We got it all wrong, she said, and we're running out of time. She hung up, got into her car, and raced back to Lost Hills with her siren on, lights flashing and gas pedal pressed to the floor, running red lights and weaving through traffic. It took her 17 minutes to travel 13 miles. Eve arrived at the station, coming to a tire-squealing stop, just as an LASD chopper was landing on the helipad. It was the sheriff. She ran into the station, pretending not to hear him shout her name over the whirring of the chopper blades. She went straight to the squad room, rushed past Duncan, and ripped the crime scene photos that she needed from the dry erase board, gathered them under her arm, then turned to face her confused partner. Where are we meeting? She demanded, breathing hard. In the captain's office, Duncan said. Let's go. She hurried down the hall, throwing open the captain's door without knocking, to find Moffat and Lansing standing there. Both men were furious. Lansing immediately confronted her. What's so goddamn important that I had to drop everything to get here? He pointed out the captain's window. There's a firestorm raging behind us. 3,000 acres have gone up in flames in the last few hours, and we're evacuating hundreds of homes. If the fire meets up with the Stevenson blaze, which is rampaging into Simi Valley now towards the Pacific, we could have one of the worst fires in state history. What do you have to tell us that's a bigger emergency than that? We screwed up the triple murder investigation, sir, she said. We got it wrong. Are you saying Lionel Coyle didn't butcher those people? That's the one thing we got right, she said. Then why the hell are we here? Because there's still a chance that we can save Caitlin Kenworth's life. Chapter 40. Three men stared at her like she'd gone insane. She was expecting that reaction. It was Moffat who spoke first, in a slow, patronizing tone that was filled with disdain. I don't see how we can save her, he said. She's already been killed and hacked into pieces. She's alive, Eve insisted. At least she was on Wednesday, and I'm hoping she still is today. Coyle took her. This triple murder was actually a child abduction. It was all along. That's what we missed. Duncan sat down. I'm confused. Join the damn club, Lansing said, taking a seat as well. Make it fast, Ronan. Every minute we sit here, another 5 acres goes up in flames. I'm well aware of that, Eve said. It's why we have to act fast. The blood evidence is conclusive, Moffat said. 3 people were killed. That's true, Eve said. I'm not disputing that. Moffat took a seat behind his desk, leaving only Eve standing. If Caitlin is still alive, Duncan said, then who is the 3rd person who got killed in Tanya's house? Donna Stokes, the realtor who was going to help Tanya find a new home to rent, Eve said. Donna has been missing since Wednesday. I think she walked in on Tanya being killed, and it's her blood in Caitlin's room. That also explains why we found no blood or anything else in Coyle's car. He used Donna's car to take away Caitlin, the body parts, and other evidence from the house. The sheriff massaged his brow. You're not making any sense. The evidence was all there from the start, but we misread it. Eve set her stack of photos on Moffat's desk and hastily sorted through them until she found the one she wanted. She held up a crime scene photo of Caitlin's room. Take a look at this. The pillowcase is missing from Caitlin's bed. The assumption was that Coyle took it, but why would he do that?
He was cleaning up evidence, Duncan said.
Of what? Eve said. The blood is on the floor and the walls. There is no blood spatter on the bed or the headboard, so there wasn't any on the pillowcase. It's gone because he used it to cover Caitlin's head.
That's a big leap, Moffat said.
She pointed to the standing fan, tapping it with her finger. We missed this fan. The power cord is cut off. That's because he used the cord to bind her. Eve tossed the photo across the desk to Moffat and pulled another one from her stack, holding it up in front of each man in turn. It was a picture of the bloody print left on the floor by one of Caitlin's shoes. This print from Caitlin's shoe was found in the hallway near the garage. The bloody print is tainted with cleaner and motor oil, so we know it was made after the killings. We assumed her shoe fell out of one of the trash bags Coyle lugged out, she said. We were wrong. Caitlin put her foot down for a moment as she was being carried away. That's proof of life.
Or it's proof that a shoe fell out of a trash bag, Lansing said.
Eve tossed the photo back on the desk, found another picture, and thrust it in Lansing's face. We also have this. It was a picture of a speck of blood on the wall. Lansing squinted at it.
Looks like just another spot of blood to me.
This one is different, she said. It's undiluted and on the wall near the footprint. It's Caitlin's blood.
How do you know that? Moffat said. Because Duncan saw Coyle naked and he didn't have a cut on him, Eve said.
Not that I could see, Duncan said.
It would need to be a big cut on his head or arm to leave a fresh spot of blood on the wall as he passed by. Did you see a cut like that?
No,
Duncan said. That's why I know it's Caitlin's blood. She must have been cut by Coyle during a struggle, or he cut her to prove he was serious like he did with the women he raped, Eve said. The DNA results on that spot of blood and the blood found in Caitlin's room will prove I'm right, but by then it will be too late to save her.
It already is, Moffat said. Caitlin is dead. She has been since Wednesday.
Eve ignored him and turned to Duncan. Remember what you said when you saw the surveillance video at Walmart and all the junk food that Coyle bought?
He eats like a kid, Duncan said.
That's because he wasn't buying the food for himself. He was buying it for her, Eve said. The Planet of the Apes DVD he bought there was for her, too.
Eve, I know you want her to be alive, Duncan said. We all wish she was, but she's not.
She looked at the faces of the three men and saw nothing but skepticism and sadness. They didn't believe her. She knew the sheriff and the captain would be a hard sell, but she was counting on Duncan to be on her side, and he wasn't. Duncan sighed.
You need to take a deep breath and be reasonable about this. You're seeing what you want to see, but it isn't there.
She wasn't going to give up. She couldn't, not while there was a chance of saving Caitlin. Eve took out her phone and swiped through the pictures that Nob sent her until she found one of Roger Karpus's gaping neck wound. She held up her phone and showed the picture to the men as she spoke. This man is Roger Karpus, a ranger at Malibu Creek State Park, where Planet of the Apes was shot. His body was left in a pickup truck sometime Wednesday night or Thursday morning on Mulholland, at Mulholland, which is only 100 yards from where Coyle lives. She swiped to a photo of the bloody knife on the passenger seat and showed it around. Lansing studied it. This is the knife that nearly took off the ranger's head. It's the knife that Coyle used to murder Tanya, Troy, and Donna, she said. I've had it sent to our lab. The DNA tests will prove me right, but it will be too late.
I'm not seeing what this all means, Lansing said as he handed the photo back to her. Because it doesn't mean a thing, Moffat said.
She took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Here is what happened. Donna Stokes walked in on Coyle butchering Tanya. Coyle killed Stokes in Caitlin's room and cut her up, too. He was still at it when Caitlin and Troy came home from school. Coyle killed the boy but kept Caitlin alive. He tied Caitlin up with the fan cord and put the pillowcase over her head. Coyle uses Donna Stokes' Mercedes to stash Caitlin somewhere and to dispose of the bodies at the ruins of the old Planet of the Apes set in Malibu Creek State Park. That's when the ranger stumbled on Coyle, who forced him at knife point to drive him nearly home. Duncan nodded, thinking it through.
So you think Coyle killed the ranger to keep him quiet, left the knife behind in the truck, and walked back to his place. From there, he either walked or rode a bike to the Topanga trailhead where his Toyota was parked. That's why the Toyota was clean.
Yes, Eve said, encouraged that Duncan was at least following the evidence. The ranger was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Coyle had to kill him to cover up his crimes. But the ranger showing up was also a golden opportunity for Coyle. The ranger gave Coyle a way to get home without using Donna's car, which could forensically link him to the murders at Tanya's house if he was caught driving the Mercedes or if it was found near his place. The car is probably still somewhere in or near Malibu Creek State Park and close to wherever Caitlin is trapped.
My God, Ronan, Moffat said, shaking his head. Listen to yourself. Your story is getting crazier by the minute.
It's not crazy. It all fits, Coyle has been arrested twice for masturbating in public while watching young girls. And those are just the two instances that we know about. He lives right behind a school for girls, so I suspect there are a lot more cases where he wasn't caught, Eve said. On top of that, he's obsessed with a movie where humans are kept as house pets. Telling me he's a pervert with an ape obsession doesn't mean he's capable of plotting the elaborate scheme you've just laid out, Moffat said. In fact, it argues persuasively against it. Eve slapped the stack of photos on Moffat's desk. I'm telling you, Caitlin is stashed somewhere, probably in a house near Malibu Creek State Park that Coyle visited before on a service call. Eve, Duncan began, but she cut him off, whirling around to face him. Don't you see, Duncan? That's what I got wrong when I interrogated Coyle. I said we were looking for Tanya, Caitlin, and Troy's body parts. He knew we didn't know that she was still alive. That's why he perked up. That's also why Coyle wanted to meet with us this morning. He's worried about Caitlin, too. He's convinced he's going to walk and wants it to happen today while there's a chance that she's still alive.
You've convinced me, Lansing said.
Eve turned, stunned. She was certain Duncan would be the first one she convinced, and he'd help her win over the others. Perhaps she'd underestimated the sheriff. But she wasn't the only one who was surprised. So was the captain. Moffat looked at Lansing in disbelief.
You can't be serious, sir.
I think she's right. Coyle killed the ranger, and the body parts we're looking for are buried somewhere in Malibu Creek State Park. Lansing turned to Eve. That was brilliant detective work, Ronan. You never cease to amaze me. We need to send deputies to every house Mr. Plunger sent Coyle to near Malibu Creek State Park, Eve said.
Whoa, hold up, Ronan, Lansing said, raising his hands in a halting gesture. I'm with you on the bodies, but your theory about Caitlin is wishful thinking, to put it kindly. I'll chalk it up to exhaustion and heartbreak. It's a horrific case, and I don't blame you for dreaming of a happy ending.
Eve felt her face flushing with anger, enraged by his lack of understanding and his patronizing lecture. How could he believe only part of what she'd told him? Recovering Caitlin was far more important than the bodies. But Donna Stokes is missing, and all the forensic evidence proves that Caitlin...
Nothing different than what we first assumed, Lansing interrupted. But even if I thought that Caitlin might be alive, and I don't, it's too dangerous to go up there right now for any reason.
We have to take that chance, Eve said. It's an inferno, Lansing said. We'll send search parties into Malibu Creek Park and deputies out to the adjacent homes that Coyle visited to look for the bodies as soon as the fire department says it's safe. Eve shook her head in defiance. No, sir, that's unacceptable. We have to act now. Caitlin is out there, trapped and alone. We can't leave her to die from dehydration or fire.
You aren't hearing me. Lansing stood up and got right into her face. She is already dead. You are not to suggest otherwise to anyone, or I will take your badge. Do you understand me? It would be unspeakably cruel to give that family false hope.
It would be worse to let her die, Eve said, and stormed out of the captain's office, slamming the door behind her. Chapter 41. Eve ran out of the station, jumped into the plane wrap Explorer, and sped to her condo, double parked at the curb, and dashed inside to grab her list of Coyle's service calls and get another look at the pushpins in her map. She couldn't sit back and let Caitlin die, not if there was still a chance of saving her. Malibu Creek State Park was bordered by Mulholland Highway to the north, Crags Road, Lake Vista Drive, and its offshoots to the west, and Las Virgenes Road to the east. The only homes that directly bordered the park were on Lake Vista, Crags Road, and the neighborhoods that rimmed the eastern edge of Malibu Lake. She checked the map and then the list, quickly identified six homes that Coyle visited adjacent to the park, and wrote the addresses on a slip of paper that she stuffed in her pocket. Now she just had to get to the houses, which wasn't going to be easy, and then deal with smoke and possibly fire when she got there to search for Caitlin. She opened the closet under her stairs, grabbed the fire extinguisher and her earthquake kit, which was a duffel bag full of supplies that included goggles, leather gloves, dust masks, a first aid kit, and a crowbar, and rushed out of the house. As soon as she got into the Explorer, she tossed her bag and the extinguisher on the passenger seat and tuned into the LASD patrol frequency to hear the latest news about the fire, evacuations, and road closures. She learned that the sheriff wasn't exaggerating about the voracious ferocity of the blaze. The fire was devouring acres by the minute, driven by single-digit humidity and blistering 50-mile-per-hour winds. The tsunami of flames had already crossed Topanga Canyon and raged west across 10 miles of mostly uninhabited wilds, eating up the parched plants for fuel and building in intensity as it jumped across Las Virgenes into Malibu Creek State Park. Officials were terrified that the Stevenson Ranch blaze, now moving through Amundsen Ranch, would connect with the Topanga blaze to create a mega fire if they weren't stopped. Eve made a sharp U-turn on Las Virgenes, hit the siren and grill flashers, and took the 101 4 miles west to the Canaan Doom Road exit. Along the way, she stole glances to her left at the thick, churning cloud of smoke that filled the sky behind the Santa Monica Mountains. She got off at Canaan, turned left, crossed through the northbound stream of ash-covered vehicles packed with people, pets, and possessions escaping from the fire, and sped south on the overpass. Sawhorse barricades at Agora Road prevented vehicles from heading south on Canaan, and two deputies stood in the intersection, directing all the traffic onto the freeway. But the deputies saw her coming in fast and furious. One deputy held up traffic for her while another moved a sawhorse aside so she could pass. She waved her thanks to the deputies and hugged the southbound shoulder because both lanes on Canaan were filled with cars fleeing the fire zone. Water-dumping helicopters streaked overhead to the front line of the fire, only a few miles southeast. A quarter mile south of Agora Road, she cut across Canaan to Cornell Road, forcing the cars full of desperate evacuees to let her slip through with insistent blurts of her siren. Eve sped down the narrow rural residential street and plowed through the curtain of smoke. Day suddenly became night, the sun almost entirely blotted out by the clouds of ash and swirling embers. 20 yards ahead, at the far edge of her diminishing field of visibility, an LASD patrol car was parked across the road as a barricade. A deputy, his face covered with a bandana, got out of the car and held up his hand for her to stop. Eve rolled down the window just enough so she could hear him talk. Smoke seeped into the Explorer. "You have to turn around," the deputy said. "The whole area south of here is under mandatory evacuation." "I know," she said. "I've been sent to check for stragglers and convince them to get the hell out, forcibly if necessary." "They'd be insane to stay. The fire is vast and out of control here. Even the firefighters are retreating in a few minutes to make their stand down at Malibu Lake and further west on Mulholland." "I'll be right behind you with anybody I've found," she said. He stepped out of her way and she drove past, slower now, moving through the dense fog of ash and embers toward Mulholland Highway. She was in a race against time, but she didn't want to mow down any firefighters in her haste. The road was awash in a flurry of blazing embers that was igniting the dry brush all around her. To her right, a meadow in Paramount Ranch looked like it was alight with dozens of campfires. To her left, on a slight rise, an entire house was ablaze, abandoned by firefighters who were now in full retreat, rolling up their water lines and piling into their trucks. The house was a lost cause, and there was nothing they could do now to prevent the firestorm from advancing. They'd have to make their stand farther west. The firefighters were leaving, but she was going in. She knew it was dangerous, but she didn't have a choice. Caitlin was out there, and Eve wasn't leaving without her. Chapter 42. Eve crossed Mulholland Highway and glanced to the east, where everything was aflame against a dark sky of billowing ash. There was a terrifying beauty to the flaming landscape. The snow flurry of embers, trees turned into towers of fire, the little bonfires everywhere. It was like Christmas in hell. The first house on her list was off of Lake Vista, though there was no lake to be seen today. It was a Spanish Mediterranean McMansion with a four-car garage, a cobblestone motor court, and a row of pine trees ringing the property that were fully engulfed in flames, bombarding the house with embers. She put on her LASD baseball cap, the pair of goggles, and a dust mask, grabbed the crowbar, and dashed up to the house. It was like running through a storm of hot needles. The front door was ajar. She pushed it open the rest of the way, rushed across the two-story foyer and into a large, open-concept kitchen and family room. It was immediately clear to her that the house had been recently occupied by a large family. The marble-topped island in the kitchen was the center of the family's life and was covered with the day's mail, the morning newspapers, and cereal boxes. There were children's toys scattered on the family room floor. Coyle couldn't have been using this house to hold Caitlin captive. It was occupied. Whoever lived here had just left in a hurry. It took Eve less than 60 seconds to make that determination and then run back outside. But in that short time, the fire had reached the house, igniting the wood under the eaves and the dried pine needles in the rain gutters. She jumped back into her car, made a fast 3-point turn, and sped out onto the road to hit the next house on her list, located on a private lane off of Lake Vista, only a quarter of a mile away. The smoke was even thicker now, swirling around her car, making it difficult to see. She caught a movement out of the corner of her eye and slammed on her brakes, nearly hitting a deer on fire. The shrieking animal charging across the road directly in front of her. The blazing deer tripped in a culvert, tumbled into the brush, and instantly ignited it. Eve couldn't allow herself to be distracted by the horrific sight and drove on as fast as she could, given her limited visibility. It was so hard to see that she almost passed the road she was looking for and would have if not for the cluster of mailboxes on the corner. She made a sharp left onto the narrow, poorly maintained road, bouncing hard into every pothole and over every bump through a tunnel of flames, embers, and smoke. At the end of the tunnel, she could see a sprawling ranch-style home surrounded by tall, dry weeds. It might as well have been in a pond of gasoline. As Eve got closer, she could see there was a car parked in front of the house. It was a metallic blue 2017 Mercedes E-Class. The fire on the roadway making the fake Swarovski crystals sparkle around the license plate. The car belonged to Donna Stokes, the missing realtor. Caitlin was here. Eve knew she didn't have much time. The flames were closing in and the house was a tinderbox. She pulled up beside the car, grabbed her crowbar and got out, leaving the motor running. She ran up to the front door and tried the knob. It was locked. She wedged the crowbar between the door and the jamb, put her full body weight into the bar, and split open the door. The house was empty and unfurnished, the hardwood floors covered with a fine layer of dust. Cobwebs filled the spaces between the wooden beams on the high-pitched ceilings. The smell of burning wood was everywhere. "Caitlin!" Eve yelled as she dashed through the house, checking every cabinet or closet that a child might fit in, and finding only dust and rat droppings. "Caitlin!" She ended up in the family room, where she stopped cold. The room was furnished with a couch, a coffee table, a rug, and an old TV set with a DVD player on top. There were cases of bottled water stacked against one wall. A sleeping bag, the one Eve had seen on the hill overlooking Tanya's house, was on the couch. An empty bag of Doritos, ding-dong wrappers, and discarded Coke cans were on the coffee table. And so was an open Planet of the Apes DVD case, the disc missing. There was no doubt now that Coyle had brought Caitlin here. But where was she? "Caitlin!" Eve yelled out again. She went back through the house, checking each room again, but finding no sign of the child. She peered outside one of the bedroom windows and saw a wave of fire coming toward the house, driven by wind and fueled by the dry brush on the abandoned property. Breaks in the smoke allowed her to see a large field between the back of the house and a rocky hillside 100 yards away. Eve went back to the family room and sat down on the couch. The flames licked at the windows on one side of the house, and the crackle of fire sounded like a monster gnashing its teeth. She took a deep breath, closed her eyes, and let her breath out slowly, forcing herself to be calm, to clear her head so she could think. Caitlin is here. Where is she hidden? Eve opened her eyes and scanned the room for any tells. There was no fresh paint or patching on the walls. The floors were covered with dust except for a path made by herself and probably Coyle from the front door to the rug. Why did he bring a rug? She bolted from the couch, grabbed the corner of the rug, and yanked it away, revealing a fresh sheet of plywood nailed to the floor. Eve jammed the crowbar under the plywood and forced it loose, the nails squealing like live animals as they were yanked from the joists, and lifted the sheet away. Caitlin, in soiled clothes, her limbs bound tightly with duct tape, was wedged face up between two joists. Another piece of duct tape with a hole cut through it for an IV tube covered her mouth. The tube ran from her mouth to an empty bottle of water wedged between her head and the next joist. Her eyes were closed, but she was breathing. Eve's instinct was to immediately lift Caitlin from her cramped space, but the cop in her remembered that this was a crime scene, one that might soon be destroyed. She took out her phone, snapped a couple quick pictures of Caitlin, then gently peeled the tape from the child's mouth and removed the straw. Eve leaned in close and carefully slipped her hands under Caitlin, who reeked of urine and sweat. I'm Eve. I'm a police officer. You're safe now. Caitlin's eyelids fluttered open and she stared at Eve.
Where is the monster?
She asked in a weak, raspy voice. Where he can't hurt you anymore. Eve glanced out the window. The flames were everywhere.
I don't have time to untie you. I'm sorry. We have to go as fast as we can.
She picked the girl up, held her close, and ran for the front door into a wailing firestorm of embers, smoke, and ash. Tall, scorching flames were blowing against one side of the house and splashing like waves against the Mercedes, which formed a wall that protected the Explorer from the fire. She opened the back door of the SUV, laid Caitlin down on the seat, belted her in, then got into the driver's seat and grabbed the radio.
This is 22 David 4 requesting emergency rescue and fire department support. I'm at 74 Castlemere Road with a 10-year-old girl who is in need of immediate medical attention.
The dispatcher responded almost immediately.
Copy 22 David 4, stand by.
Eve assessed her grim situation. The brush around the house was ablaze. She glanced in the rearview mirror. The road behind her was a wall of flame, burning trees falling across the roadway, kicking up blasts of embers. It was impassable. She remembered the field behind the house, and behind it the rocky hillside, but it was all hidden by a curtain of smoke. Was it already on fire?
22 David 4, the dispatcher said. Ground rescue is impossible. Air support is en route. Can you get to an open field or to higher ground?
I'll find a way, Eve said.
She secured her seatbelt, turned on the headlights, backed up, then put the car into drive, pressed the gas pedal to the floor, and charged into the curtain of smoke, bursting through the brown haze into the tall, thick, brittle brush. The field wasn't on fire yet, but it soon would be. The tall vegetation and smoke made it virtually impossible to see what she was driving into, but she had no choice but to venture on as fast as she could. The Explorer bounced violently on the hard scrabble dirt, through the bushes and weeds, jostling her hard from side to side.
I apologize about the rough ride, Eve said to Caitlin. It will be over soon. She wrestled to control the car and peered intently into the dense smoke, hoping for a break that would show her the way. Instead, a tree broke through the haze like a runaway freight train. She yanked the wheel hard to the right, sideswiping the tree and shearing off her mirror. Within seconds of avoiding the tree, the Explorer slammed into a boulder hidden by the brush and came to a brutal stop. The airbag exploded in Eve's face, stunning her. It took a long second for Eve to regain her senses. Blood ran down her forehead. The front end of the Explorer was crumpled. The car wasn't going anywhere. She looked over her shoulder into the back seat. Somehow, Caitlin hadn't ended up on the floor. She was crying, but otherwise unhurt. "We're going to be okay," Eve said, and looked out the back window. The house was consumed by fire, igniting the brush behind them, the voracious flames moving at incredible speed in their direction. She reached out for the radio and felt a pain so sharp, intense, and unexpected that she choked back a scream. Her right wrist was broken, and she knew how it had happened. She'd been gripping the steering wheel hard when the collision happened, and the airbag blasted open against her rigid arm. It was a common injury, but that knowledge didn't make it any less painful or inconvenient now. There was no time to make a brace. She'd have to power through it. She picked up the radio with her left hand. 22 David 4, we're going on foot, heading south of the house. There was no response. Eve could only hope that someone heard what she'd said. She got out of the car, opened the back door, reached down to pick up Caitlin, bracing herself for the agony. It felt like an iron spike was driving into her arm. She gritted her teeth against the pain, lifted up the child, and tried to shift most of Caitlin's dead weight onto her left arm. "I've got you," Eve said. "I'm not going to let you go." She didn't know if she was trying to reassure Caitlin or herself, but they could both use it. Eve trudged forward through the brush, moving as fast as she could without tripping, hearing the crackling and feeling the heat on her back of the firestorm closing in. Blood from her scalp rolled into her eyes, stinging and blinding her, but she kept on. Her right wrist felt like it might snap off, and that the only thing holding it together against the child's weight and the sheer agony was Eve's unbending will. "There's no fucking way I'm dropping this child. There's no fucking way I'm letting that fire catch us." She stumbled on a gopher hole, staggered to maintain her balance, and couldn't help crying out with pain when Caitlin's full weight momentarily shifted to her broken wrist. Eve wasn't sure whether it was tears or streams of blood that were running down her cheeks. It may have been both. But then she heard the whap, whap, whap of a helicopter approaching. She stopped to look over her shoulder. A water-dropping helicopter came up behind them and doused the leading edge of the flames, buying Eve and Caitlin some time. The helicopter banked away, and a moment later, a larger Los Angeles County Fire Department rescue chopper appeared overhead, its rotors whipping up the air all around them as it descended into the field a few yards ahead of her. Two firefighters immediately leaped out of the open side door and rushed up to Eve. One firefighter took Caitlin from her, and the other clutched Eve by her left forearm and led her quickly to the chopper. They climbed on board where two emergency medical technicians waiting inside laid Caitlin on a gurney. A firefighter buckled Eve into her seat. She braced her limp right arm with her left hand, hoping to ease the pain caused by each movement of her body or the aircraft. The chopper rose up and banked over the abandoned house, which was fully engulfed in flames. Then high over Malibu Creek State Park, much of it a sea of fire, then headed north toward West Hills Hospital, the nearest emergency medical facility. Eve looked over at the EMTs, one of whom leaned over Caitlin, cutting away the duct tape that bound her, while the other prepared an IV. A firefighter gently wiped the blood and dirt from around her eyes with moist pieces of cotton and yelled so Eve would hear him over the rotors, "You're crazy, you know that?" She glanced down at Caitlin and decided that maybe being crazy was necessary now and then.
Chapter 43.
You're insane, Lisa said, applying the final layer of moist blue fiberglass tape to Eve's short arm cast. It was perhaps the fifth or sixth time her sister had shared that observation in one form or another since Eve came into the West Hills Hospital ER. Eve had lost count of how many other people had expressed the same sentiment over the last 2 hours. Eve sat on the edge of the gurney and looked across the chaotic ER full of firefighters and civilians injured in the blaze to the set of closed doors where doctors, an LASD detective experienced in crimes against children, and a Los Angeles County caseworker from Child Protective Services were taking care of Caitlin. The child hadn't said a word since they'd fled the house, and Eve hadn't asked her any questions. But Eve had stayed by Caitlin's side, refusing treatment for herself until she was certain that the child was in good hands. Caitlin was safe now, but Eve couldn't get the image of the little girl wedged between those floor joists out of her mind. She'd rescued Caitlin, but Eve was frustrated that there was nothing she could do to spare the child from reliving the horrors that she'd seen and experienced. At least Caitlin would know that Lionel Coyle would never be able to hurt her or anyone else again. The cut on your head isn't new, Lisa said. The airbag blowing up in your face opened up the old wound. You're lucky your injuries aren't a lot worse.
I was just doing my job.
The hell you were. Suicide isn't part of your job description. It's a miracle you're both alive.
Don't get me wrong. I'm thankful for what you did. Probably everybody in the country is going to be when they hear about it.
But I could have lost you today because you acted without thinking.
Eve saw tears in her sister's eyes.
I was thinking of Caitlin.
I'd appreciate it if you'd think of yourself now and then.
In a way, I was. I couldn't live with myself if I was right about her being alive and she'd burned to death in that house.
Lisa was finished with the cast and peeled off her rubber gloves.
I'd get you a sling for your arm, but I know you won't use it, or the Vicodin the doctor prescribed for pain. So my prescription is that you go home, eat a half gallon of Ben and Jerry's Chunky Monkey, and binge on the Terminator movies.
I can do that.
Eve's phone vibrated beside her on the gurney. She picked it up with her left hand and saw a text from Duncan informing her that he was outside and on his way in.
I've got to go, Eve said.
She slid off the gurney and hugged her sister.
Thanks for patching me up.
I'll come by later tonight with extra meds, Lisa said.
Oreo cookies?
With double stuff.
Isn't that extreme? Eve said.
I have a broken wrist. I'm not dying of cancer.
Eve gave her sister a kiss on the cheek and headed out to the lobby where two deputies were stationed. She emerged just as Duncan came in from the parking lot with Cleve Kenworth, who rushed up to Eve so fast she was afraid he might tackle her.
Is it true? Cleve asked. Is Caitlin really alive?
She's severely dehydrated and confused, but the doctors say she'll be fine. She's in exam room 5. One of the deputies will take you back.
I can't believe it.
Cleve started to tear up.
I don't know how to thank you.
Take her home, keep her safe, and give her that Brady Bunch family you told me about.
Cleve gave her a firm hug, took a deep breath, and went back into the ER with a deputy, leaving her with Duncan.
It's an amazing thing you did today, he said.
Not insane?
Oh, it was that, too. But I figure you've heard that enough already.
Thanks, she said.
The captain is furious, ranting about insubordination and the explorer you destroyed, but I think he'll overlook it given the circumstances.
And if I don't tell anybody that he and the sheriff didn't believe me that Caitlin was alive and being held captive?
All that matters is that Caitlin's safe.
Duncan tipped his head toward the doors to the ER and lowered his voice to a near whisper.
Did Coyle sexually abuse her?
Eve shrugged. She didn't know, and she didn't want to think about it. Not now, anyway. The house is ashes, but I got pictures of the crime scene before we fled.
Duncan looked at her in disbelief.
You did?
Of course, wouldn't you?
Hell no, Duncan said. But I wouldn't have been there in the first place. I value my life. Running into a raging wildfire on a hunch is suicidal.
It was more than a hunch. You heard me present the evidence to Moffat and Lansing. It was a certainty.
Only to you, Duncan said. I'm not ashamed that I was unconvinced. You were right this time, but next time you might not be.
Then next time you'll just have to come along to keep me out of trouble.
Not me. I'll be working on my long putt in Palm Springs.
You've still got 161 days to go before that happens.
160, he said.
A lot could happen between now and then. Has the word gone out yet that Caitlin is alive? Duncan shook his head.
Lansing is still trying to figure out how to spin it.
That's great. Eve took him by the arm and started hustling him toward the door. You need to take me downtown to see Coyle.
Now?
Lights and siren and pedal to the floor, she said. I want Coyle to hear the news from me. Lionel Coyle was waiting for Eve in the visitor's room in the men's central jail. She left Duncan in the hallway and went in alone. Coyle broke into a big smile when he saw her.
Ouch, he said. What happened to you?
She sat down across the table from him. I had a car accident. I came here straight from the hospital.
Of course you did. The clock is ticking, and the moment of truth is tomorrow morning. You didn't want to waste a second.
No, I didn't.
I knew you'd be back today. You want to know why?
He leaned forward, arms on the table, and looked her in the eye.
Because my lawyer dismembered you. Are you ready for our selfie?
I'll take it later when you're strapped to a table getting your lethal injection.
He laughed. Is that the best you've got?
She leaned forward now, not breaking eye contact.
I've got Caitlin.
Coyle tried to sustain his smile, but it wavered at the edges.
You must have banged your head real hard in that accident. You're not making sense.
She's alive. I found her under the floor of that empty house near Malibu Creek State Park. I wanted you to hear it from me first. Coyle's smile vanished as his face went pale so fast that Eve thought he might be about to throw up. She sat back just in case.
I'll make a deal with you, he said. You don't have anything I want. I'll tell you where the bodies are.
I know where they are, Lionel. They're in the ruins of the old Planet of the Apes set.
But you don't know exactly where, do you? It's a big park. I can take you straight to them, on one condition.
He leaned forward again and whispered.
After I show you where the bodies are, maybe on the way back to the car, you let me escape and then shoot me dead before I get away.
It was an outrageous request, and it surprised her.
Why would I want to do that? Think of all the publicity, he said.
He wanted his death to be fast and memorable, and it sickened her that he believed she'd actually go for it just so she could have a few more minutes of fame. She stood up. I'm going to enjoy watching you die.
Wait, he said.
But Eve turned her back on him and walked out of the room. Duncan was leaning against a wall, scrolling through something on his phone screen when she stepped into the hallway.
How did it go?
Duncan asked, looking up from his phone. He wanted to make a deal.
A little late for that. The news broke while you were inside with him. Your video is going viral.
I don't see why. Eve started walking down the hall, Duncan falling into step beside her. The video is old news.
Not that one. I'm talking about Death Fist 2, your new viral video.
I don't have a new video.
Yes, you do. There was a camera mounted on the chopper that picked you up. One of the firefighters leaked the video to the press. It's you with Caitlin in your arms, running across a field chased by a firestorm. It's pretty amazing stuff.
He stopped and showed her the video on his phone. The woman on screen, her bloody face set in grim determination, held the child tight to her chest and ran toward the camera, the tongues of flame licking at her back. Eve didn't see herself in the video. It was as if the woman with the blood and soot on her face was somebody else. Duncan pocketed his phone.
Don't let me forget to get your autograph once the cast is off.
Eve suddenly felt very tired. You know what I really need right now? A William Morris agent? A donut, she said.
That's the best idea you've had since the day we met.
He smiled, put a fatherly arm around her, and gently led her toward the security gate.
I'm starting to think you might just make it as a homicide detective, though I suppose now you'll want to be sheriff.
Not yet, Eve said.
You sure? After what you did today and this video, you could probably win the election in a landslide.
I think I still have a few more things to learn.
That's the first lesson right there, he said. The second is never get a donut filled with anything because it's going to end up on your shirt.
You're a fount of wisdom, Duncan. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Lost Hills by Lee Goldberg, performed by Nicole Zanzarella. Performance copyright 2019 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc., all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brilliancepublishing.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.